From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The second day of the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, recorded on death row in Pennsylvania. Also tonight, a frontline documentary on the unreliability of eyewitness identification, especially cross-racial. We examine what Jennifer saw.
I remember feeling just an overwhelming sense of just guilt that if indeed we had made a mistake and I had contributed to taking away 11 years of this man's life, and if indeed we had been wrong, I felt so bad. I fell apart.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. On the day Deng Xiaoping was cremated, the Secretary of State met with President Zhang and Premier Li. She said she raised concerns on human rights issues, including China's plan to roll back civil rights laws in Hong Kong, adding later it was likely the U.S. will again co-sponsor a resolution criticizing China's record at a U.N. conference in March. Critics of U.S. policy toward China have long said that the U.S. has not considered China's human rights abuses seriously. Ordinary birth control pills can halt pregnancies if taken in sufficient quantities within 3 days of unprotected sex, this according to the FDA. The agency giving details on dosages said 6 brands of the pill can safely be used as morning-after pills. It added that the pill's effectiveness for this use has been known but kept quiet for some time. The FBI says there are distinct similarities between a bomb that went off at a lesbian nightclub in Atlanta and earlier bombings at an abortion clinic and an Olympics concert. A militant Christian group sent a letter to a news agency claiming responsibility for Friday's blast, but authorities couldn't say if it was genuine. South African President Nelson Mandela called for an African summit next month to spur Zaire's Mobutu to seek talks on ending a war with rebels. The South African president refused to say whether the two sides met over the weekend in negotiations he announced, perhaps prematurely, last week. Meanwhile, 9 Zairean army officers said they are joining the rebels. Turkey's military says it has all but crushed a 12-year Kurdish revolt and signaled concern over Islamic fundamentalism and moves by Greece. The rare news briefing was held on the eve of a censure vote that the government, led by an Islamic party, is expected to survive. New York State Comptroller H. Carl McCall, who controls 3.4 million shares of Walt Disney stock as sole trustee of New York's public pension fund, is raising objections to management of the company. McCall said he opposes a proposed pay increase for Disney CEO Michael Eisner. McCall said he will also vote against the re-election of 5 company directors. He said that stems from the $100 million severance package paid to Michael Ovitz, who left the company after 4 months. McCall says it's a mistake to pay $100 million to a man who worked there for so short a period of time. McCall is the sole trustee of a $60 billion common retirement fund for New Yorkers. Disney stockholders are being asked to approve a new 10-year contract for Eisner with stock options worth nearly $200 million. The U.S. government will pay $6.2 million to provide safe drinking water to 500 families threatened by radioactive water leaking from Brookhaven National Laboratories in Long Island, New York. New York Senator Alphonse D'Amato says people are worried about the water, even though it's 1 mile away. The lab is leaking tritium. The town of Brookhaven is going to be hooked up to a new water supply. And this news from Washington, the Education Department says school drug prevention programs are having little impact on drug use. A study particularly questions the effectiveness of the highly popular DARE program. DARE, which stands for Drug Abuse Resistance Education, relies on visits by police officers to fifth grade classes. Department officials said the report found better results at schools where students took part in programs other than DARE. Even so, the department says it wants to spend more for drug education and prevention in 1998, but tighten controls on who gets the money. The study says schools spend too little on prevention. The Central Intelligence Agency, according to the New York Times, told the Army that U.S. soldiers may have been exposed to Iraqi chemical agents in 1991. The New York Times says recently declassified documents undermine the Pentagon's repeated assertion that it was unaware of the possible exposure until last year. The paper says the documents show that UN investigators had found damaged rockets filled with the nerve gas sarin in the wreckage of an Iraqi ammunition dump blown up by American GIs, and that the CIA warned the Army about the risk of chemical contamination as a result of the demolition. But the Times says the Army failed to conduct a thorough investigation, and the information was put aside for more than 4 years. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, yesterday unilaterally canceled Democracy Now! And pulled all Pacifica programming, including the Pacifica Network News, from its radio station WRTI, otherwise known as Jazz FM. Also affected were 11 other radio stations across Pennsylvania, southern New Jersey, and Delaware, all part of the Temple University Public Radio Network. The sudden decision was made as Democracy Now! Began to air commentaries from Pennsylvania death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal. Convicted in 1982 of the killing of a police officer the year before, Daniel Faulkner, a crime he says he did not commit. University Administrator George Ingram said that the university was planning to change programming on WRTI, but he added that the airing of Mumia's commentaries hastened the decision to cancel Democracy Now! And Pacifica Network News. Ingram said the commentaries were inappropriate. The decision by university administrators has sparked immediate protest from listeners and the university community, who branded the move censorship and an attack upon academic freedom. Today, we bring you this third in a series of commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest growing public housing tract in America. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. A growing panic is brewing in the so-called civilized world over the mad cow disease recently uncovered in England, with a disease passed over to humans by their eating of tainted meat. Hundreds of millions of meat eaters are forced to do something that the multi-billion dollar meat industry has tried to do their level best to prevent. To have consumers think of the Big Mac, the fat burger, the everything on it beef burger, as the flesh of a sentient, once living being, or to put it more nakedly, as a dead cow. Modern day packaging conspires to have us ignore much of what we eat. For as the old advertising axiom informs us, sell the sizzle, not the steak, we are driven by the familiar, the comfortable, deadly habits that stifle our thinking and silences the human faculty of questioning. We go to massive food factories called supermarkets and literally pay for our poisons, mega chemical laden dead foods, juices that have never wet the insides of fruit, eggs that have never seen the inside of chickens, and meats that come from four-legged, dazed dope addicts fed on awful, awful. With the hypnotic magic of a sexy jingle in our heads, things go better with, have it your own way, etc., or our eyes dazed by a hip label, we put our down payment on our deaths. Meanwhile, the same authorities assure us that we face minimal risk. Move political prisoner and revolutionary naturalist Mike Africa dashes that old claim. That's, of course, what they say about everything they produce, because ain't none of that stuff safe. But now people are looking at that minimal risk that people are talking about, and it makes them look at who's telling them that. All them years the cigarette industry been telling people that cigarettes don't cause cancer in the face of cancer-ridden millions who smoke. Nuclear plants parked next to residential districts telling them people would pose minimal risk while the town is full of legless children, babies born with hearts outside their chest, and industry saying the cause is something else. MOVE founder John Africa unequivocally condemns the entire system that feeds the people death for profit. Quote, this system has misled people to believe that they can't live comfortably with the single principle of God and can't live comfortably without the multi-problems of industry. For the system has created a policy of sickness, tricked folks into believing that they can't do without industry. It is insane not to resist something that gives nothing but sickness to you, your mothers, your fathers, your babies, your family. Unquote. John Africa. Long live John Africa. With every bite of beef henceforth must be mingled the fear that accompanies the knowledge that the beast on which you feed may have fed on another diseased beast, or fed on shredded newspaper, or on offal. Will you trust the merchant? Will you trust yourself? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that was Mumia Abu-Jamal, recorded this past October in SCI Green, which is the State Correctional Institute in Pennsylvania. You're listening to Democracy Now!, joining us to talk today about the media, prisons, and also the case of the outcry against Mumia Abu-Jamal, or I should say, the University of in Pennsylvania, Temple University's refusal to air the commentaries of a man on death row. We have two guests. We're joined by Ben Bagdikian. He's in our studios in California. He's in KPFA studios in Berkeley. He's formerly the dean of the School of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley, and author of The Media Monopoly, before hitting the national spotlight with the publication of the Pentagon Papers. Bagdikian published two books on prisons, including The Shame of the Prisons and another book called Caged. We're also joined by Mark McLean Taylor, the coordinator of academics for Mumia Abu-Jamal, a national group of some 700 academics. He's a professor of religion and culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary. Well, why don't we begin with the whole issue of journalists' access to prisons? And I wanted to begin with you, Ben Bagdikian. I don't know if people realize your involvement with fighting for journalists to get access to prisoners. You're well known for convincing Katharine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, to publish the Pentagon Papers, but your work on prisons is not quite as well known, perhaps, to some. Can you tell us why you think prisons are a critical issue for journalists, a critical area for them to investigate?
Fastest growing industries in the country. There's a prison industrial complex. There's a huge set of industries and politics which depend on increased incarceration, increased death sentences, increased prison building. Contrary to all that we know about the futility of this kind of mindless expansion, and it is a reversion to the old political reversion to the old primitive revenge idea, even in the face of what we know is alternatives that work much better, especially with early offenders, especially with nonviolent offenders, especially with drug addicts, and we know better, but it is too hot a political issue, and there are very few voices that are heard by most of the country on their television sets, on their standard television outlets, standard radio outlets, and standard newspapers, on how irrational this is. And when I was doing my books, one of them was done in a period of reform in the early 70s, late 60s, in which the people who knew that incarceration as a kind of reflex reaction to crime, with all of its illogicalities and injustices, just simply made no sense in terms of protecting society. There were changes, and there were people in some positions of influence who could make those improvements. I talked to dozens and dozens of wardens across the country. Great majority of them said in the privacy of their offices that they knew that incarceration not only did not cure crime, but it usually increased the intensity of crime because It limits the imprisoner to a place, first of all, which is not designed to turn you into a normal human being. It's designed to turn you into a caged animal. And you associate with people who both fear each other and need each other and protect each other with wild stories about physical prowess. And then after 2, 3, 5, 10 years of imprisonment, in which you live in a cell and go maybe to a workshop on a lockstep schedule, they take you to the gate and give you $10 or whatever. Say, okay, go on out in society. Worse off than you were when you came in.
Ben Bagdikian, could you talk about the time that you were in a maximum security prison in, well, none other than Pennsylvania in the early 70s?
Well, I had spent 3, 4, 5 months going around the country talking to wardens, ex-wardens, prisoners, ex-prisoners, psychiatrists, criminologists, everybody involved in that. And I'd walked through dozens of prisons. And after a while, I felt it's like going through a zoo. You walk through, they all tend to be the same. You're looking through a set of bars at someone who is in a prison uniform or dungarees. And there's a kind of sameness and sullenness. And then when you get down to isolation wards, they get induced psychosis. And after a while, I had a feeling that what I'm looking at is what it looks like from the outside. And so what I wanted to do was to spend a little time inside. Not that I expected that I would get anything spectacular, but that somehow, as a reporter, I'd always felt that if you're doing a story in some depth, after you do all of the objective reporting, you try to immerse yourself in the environment to get some feeling of what it's like on the side on which you are reporting. Now, whether this is on the poor, I did a book on the poor, so I lived with various kinds of poor for a few months and so forth. So I went around the country trying to find a director of corrections, and it turned out a governor, who would let me go into a prison where nobody, warden or prisoners, knew that I was not an actual prisoner, because reporters from time to time spend a night in prison. Judges sometimes do, and they're shaken by it usually. But I didn't. But when they do that, they are obviously treated very carefully. Wardens put them in places where the guards are told, now watch this, put them in the safest part of the prison. Don't let them circulate too much with the population, or the prisoners know. And I wanted to go in where nobody knew. I almost got in Oklahoma because there was a reformist governor and director of corrections there at that time. And then at the last minute, someone down in McAllister State Prison heard that somebody funny is coming in. Well, somebody funny in a prison means an informer who's trying to get the goods on somebody. Not a very good idea if you don't want your life insurance canceled. So I went to, I finally found in Pennsylvania, there was a Attorney General, Shane Kramer, who's a reformist. There was a Director of Corrections, Seeleff, who was a reformist, who one of these people who knew better, and unlike many others who knew better, spoke out. And they agreed that they would have me put into the prison, a maximum security prison in Greaterford Prison, delivered by a confidential unit of the state police, so that everybody in the prison, including the warden, would think I'm simply being transferred from a county jail being held for murder, which is an unbailable offense under most circumstances. So I spent a little time, not much time, and in one of the regular cell blocks, and went through. And the thing that I learned was that I didn't learn when I was looking at it from the outside, was the speed with which normal society recedes. I mean 24 hours. And the outside world, the relations of the outside world, the sensory experience on the outside world is as though it were 100 years ago away. Because everything you see tells you you are not in the normal world. There is tile, there is steel. And it's a hard environment. You do live by lockstep. And also what I didn't know was the kind of depression that descends on you so fast because your sensory intake is cut back. And so I, for example, the second day we were marching to Chau, you go by one of those corner mirrors so that guards at night can see two cell blocks at the same time from one desk. And so we could see ourselves marching to Chau, and you always want to know who's in front of you and behind you, who's new and so forth. And I saw a new guy in there, and I wondered who he was. It was me. I didn't recognize myself after 2 days.
Hmm. Ben Bagdikian, we have to break to let our stations ID themselves. But when we come back, we'll find out what you learned, what the Supreme Court case was that you lost. And then we want to hear from Mark McLean Taylor, who is currently dealing with the issue of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a prisoner on death row in Pennsylvania, and his voice being heard. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, and I do think that Ben Bagdikian is a good example of the exception to the rulers. Ben Bagdikian, formerly the Dean of the School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of The Media Monopoly, well known for that, and bringing the Pentagon Papers to all of our attention as he worked for The Washington Post. But before that, his work on prisons, and through that, one book called The Shame of the Prisons, the other called Caged. You were just saying what you learned from your experience in a maximum security prison in Pennsylvania.
Well, it depresses one so that all of the sensory reactions that have you respond to normal society, which is, in a way, the civilizing influence in our lives, falls away. You're surrounded by people who are caged the way you are. Many of them are hardened criminals. Many of them are first-time offenders. I think most of the people in prisons probably did commit the crimes they were accused of. Not all of them, because it turns out that it's a proven incidence of people improperly incarcerated. And when you get to know about them and their home life, their treatment by police very early, there's a terrible inevitability and futility of the system, which is not to say that we're never going to have prisons, but I think there are people who are violent for all kinds of reasons and who, for the safety of themselves and society, will be incarcerated. But it's a minor percentage of the people we do incarcerate. We're the most heavily imprisoned democracy in the world.
Ben Bagdikian, and you brought us a Supreme Court case. You were behind a Supreme Court case, and ultimately you lost. The Supreme Court ruled that journalists don't have a guaranteed right to go into prisons and interview prisoners. Is that right?
Yes. And I think prisons are the most protected institution from outside accountability in our society. And we just know the whole basis of society, of democratic society, is accountability. You take that away, and you take a prison, which is already is bound. It's an enclosed institution. The guards are overwhelmingly outnumbered by the number of prisons. The prisoners are powerless. The guards have power. The guards are fearful because they are their numbers are the ratio is so different. And So if you keep that institution unaccountable, where people can't visit without warning, bad things are almost inevitably going to happen. And the bad things happen and are easily covered up. I mean, it's a joke among guards. If they beat up somebody, the answer to the public is they fell down a set of stairs. And, you know, you see, I think Jose is going to fall down a set of stairs, which means you're going to take him down and beat him. And so that, now, that doesn't mean that all guards are savages. It doesn't mean that all prisons are filled with savagery. But the whole pressure of that incarceration is to produce savagery. And it has to be looked at regularly, not by plan, because there's a way prisons know how to handle visitors' day. They take them to the kitchens, shiny pots, absolutely clean. They take them to the library. They take them to a cell block where everything's been scrubbed down. They frequently will repaint a cell block before visitors' day, if they have one, or if the governor's going to visit. So you get a false picture, even when they let somebody in, if it is a planned event.
Ben Bagdikian, I want to bring Mark McLean Taylor into this conversation. I mean, I think your insight into going into prisons and your experience in the prisons is extremely significant as a journalist for many decades and one yourself who is trained journalist. Mark McLean Taylor, you're coordinator of academics for Mumia Abu-Jamal, a national group of some 700 professors. You're currently at the Princeton Theological Seminary. How would you say what Ben Bagdikian is talking about fits in to the story of Mumia Abu-Jamal? And I'm not talking about his innocence or his guilt or the case, the reason why he's on death row right now, but in terms of his access to journalists. He himself, in fact, is a journalist as well.
Well, I think that is the question that is really on target, because the rates of incarceration we are seeing today not only impact negatively those that are inside our jails and prisons, they impact all of us in a society that organizes around such massive prison building. Mr. Bagdikian used the word prison industrial complex, and indeed the National Criminal Justice Commission has reported that the United States since 1980 has engaged in the largest and most frenetic corrections buildup of any country in the history of the world, was their rather striking language. What that means for all of us is that the patterns of incarceration, regimentation, confinement, cruel limitation, these spread throughout the society and affect media, they affect academic freedoms, they limit that. And these are all points that Mumia Abu-Jamal has named very, very clearly in the very beginning of the newest book by Mumia. For example, I recall a passage where Mumia Abu-Jamal writes that newspapers, radio, and TV are increasingly the property of multinational corporate power or wealthy individuals and reflect the perspective of the rich and the established, not the poor and the powerless. And that's a message that often doesn't get out in a regimented society. And those of us who have organized as academics around Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, and we're in other movements as well, see Mumia's case because he, as a writer and a courageous journalist, has addressed these systemic questions pertaining to how media expression and academic freedom is confined by corporate power and abuse of power in our society today.
Mark McLean Taylor, what do you say to those who say a murderer should not be heard?
Well, we have free rights of expression that I think one of our members addressed very well in the pages of Nation magazine in July of 1995, Patricia Williams. She argued as a professor of law at Columbia University Law School that we all in the society need the perspective not only of those who have committed murder, but of the many who are in our prisons and jails. We need more prison and jail anthologies. If Dostoevsky was right that the quality of a nation can be judged by the state of its prisons, we are not going to understand the quality of our own nation without insight coming from inside our prisons and the perspective on the whole nation that emerges from there. So we all stand in need of the perspective of those who are writing within our prisons, whether they are convicted there of murder or not.
What do you think of Temple University's decision to drop Democracy Now! Because we were airing the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal? Again, they dropped it yesterday because that would be the first of the commentaries that we were running.
Right. Well, I think it's a very instructive case and one that we have to be organizing around, and indeed are. Often the power of global elites remain out of the public eye, even when they have enormous decision-making power. With this move against WRTI, I think we see the power of business, and in particular the Fraternal Order of Police, to pressure a media outlet in such a way that there is a dampening of both the right to have a free press in the media realm and a dampening of academic freedom. I've been speaking with some of the faculty at Temple University, and it has been pointed out to me that often Temple University gets credit and applause for staying in North Philly in a very urban area of the city, and is devoted and significant amounts of their economic budget to the city. But with this kind of move to drop Democracy Now! In the very week when commentaries by Mumia were being aired, suggests that Temple University's administrators, whatever the benefits of some of their other policies, have decided to trade away rights to free expression for that presence, and that is very concerning and needs to be organized against.
You know, Professor Taylor, it sounds like this isn't the first time that issues like these have come up at Temple. I was talking to a professor last night who was saying that a graduate student in the last years had actually assigned Mumia Abu-Jamal's first book, Live from Death Row, to her class, and that a member of the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, had seen it in the school bookstore.
That's right.
And that ultimately the provost called the student and said that this was off the required reading list, that it would no longer be required reading.
Right. She was allowed to, this was in 1995, she was allowed to go ahead and teach the book, but she was not allowed to require it. And the provost also gave students in the class special permission to transfer out of the class. Now, note the pressure here of the Fraternal Order of Police. For those of us who work universities and colleges and envision ourselves to have freedoms here, this is a fairly flagrant violation by law enforcement in its impact on the university life. The other place where this pressure is evident is in the area of the financing. As I understand it, 40% of Temple University's budget is from the state legislature, and whether or not it's true or not, it is thought that the Fraternal Order of Police have significant influence in Pennsylvania over a state legislature which is inclined to listen often to the Fraternal Order of Police. So to stand up to law enforcement, to the Fraternal Order of Police, is, well, let's just say it takes some courage when you're dealing with 40% of your budget.
Well, it's not only the Fraternal Order of Police, is it? Because if we're talking about state funding, we're talking about ultimately the ultimate arbiter of this is the governor. And the governor of Pennsylvania is Tom Ridge, the man who signed the original death warrant for Mumia Abu-Jamal and who is considering doing this again.
And then I think one needs to see how the governor is situated within a whole set of strategies for corporate investment, not only in Philadelphia, but throughout Pennsylvania, and indeed the nation. I mean, as early as the late 1950s, E. Digby Baltzel, a University of Pennsylvania sociologist, wrote a book about the Philadelphia upper class and its connections to a national upper class. These connections are very important, and we're seeing once again through the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal how organized elite power will repress voices that really seek to get an alternative word out there.
Well, let me ask Ben Bagdikian. You were covering prisons in the 1970s. What do you think when you hear about this case today?
I think that, first of all, I think that there's a it's a very considered policy. I was in the military service during World War II, and one part of your training is to dehumanize the enemy so that it tends to remove the inherent feeling of killing another that prevents you from killing another human being. And I think that access to prisoners in death row might humanize them. It might force society to look into the eyes of a person and say, I, a person in society, are going to condone killing you, whom I now see. So that I think, first of all, they want to keep prisoners dehumanized in the eye of the public so that their treatment becomes a non-feeling. And I must say that talking about the Fraternity Order of Police in Pennsylvania, in the late 60s, the state of California adopted a community treatment program for young offenders, which consisted of young people who were had education experience and all kinds of other things, and they would go to the this young group who would discover that prisoners had dyslexia, they were came from families that had alcoholic parents. They were so effective throughout the state that they canceled a juvenile prison building system and began emptying the juvenile prisons. And it was the peace officers' lobby in California, extremely powerful. The whole criminal justice operation killed that program because it was emptying the prisons, taking away jobs to guards, prosecutors, police, and so forth.
And isn't it true that the prison guard lobby in California is the second most powerful lobby in the state?
And they killed this program, which was more effective than prisons in returning young offenders to useful life. And I think that's a replication, apparently, what's going on in Pennsylvania now.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, both Ben Bagdikian, who is joining us from Berkeley, Ben Bagdikian, the author of many books, including two on the prisons in this country, The Shame of the Prisons, and also Caged. These are way out of print, but you might be able to find an old copy somewhere if you don't already have one. Ben Bagdikian, known for his refusal to back down on the publishing of the Pentagon Papers at the Washington Post. He's also author of The Media Monopoly. And we've been joined by Mark McLean Taylor, coordinator of academics for Mumia Abu-Jamal, this national group of around 700 academics. And he's professor of religion and culture at the Princeton Theological Seminary. You know, at WRTI in Philadelphia, they're giving out a number on the air for people to call if they're concerned about the dropping of Democracy Now! And they give the Associate Vice President of University Relations, George Ingram's number. But he is just the Vice President, and there's a man he answers to. There is someone higher up, and that is Temple University President Peter Liakouris, who, by the way, is known for his support of freedom of the press. And his number, if people are interested in letting him know how you feel, is 215-204-7405. That's 215-204-7405. Last night at 10 o'clock on WRTI and Jazz FM, one of the DJs opened the phones to calls for 3 hours. Overwhelming number of calls. All of them were talking about Democracy Now! And the fact that Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries were not allowed to be heard on their station. Well, we got a bunch of calls also about our airing of Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries. And these are what some people had to say.
Hi, I would just like to applaud you for your commentaries this morning that was given by Mr. Abu-Jamal. I normally listen to NPR in Chicago on WBEZ, and I am visiting in Colorado, and I picked up your broadcast this morning on KGNU, and I really appreciated that, and I was surprised that NPR would not broadcast this commentary by Mr. Jamal. I also called NPR, and I was transferred to about four people before I finally got a voicemail for Kathy Scott. And Kathy Scott has not bothered to return my call since 2 hours this morning. So I assume that this is really a hot potato. And I had not been familiar with the situation with Mr. Jamal. And I appreciate the information. Keep up the good work.
my name is Evelyn Ann Cunningham, and I'm calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. It's with dismay and quite and disappointment that Pacifica News is not being carried on WRTI today. That is Philadelphia's Temple University's radio station, with my understanding that there would be some taped conversation with Mumia Abdul-Jamal. And so it's very interesting that Temple that it is not on the air today. I'm just calling actually to express my support for Pacifica News and to find out how I might, what might be done and how I might support this situation.
My name is Eric Thomas, and I'm calling from the Philadelphia area. I just learned today that the Democracy Now! Has been canceled by WRTI. I was saddened to hear that. And I wrote this poem about it. Democracy later. And now a word from the loyal opposition. Thou shalt not speak ill of them that got, unless you want to be preempted by college basketball, traffic updates, or the supermarket to the world. Them that got a dime to drop, the same old bag, it's a flop. Them that can't spare even an hour out of the day for voices up from the bottom. And so democracy is preempted, not by imprisonment or bullets to the brain. It is preempted by them that got. If there's another way for me to gain access to the program in the Philadelphia area, I'd sure love to know about it.
Well, I want to thank all the people who have called. That's just a small sampling. If you'd like to give us a call and share your comments, how you feel about the airing of Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries, you can give us a call on our comment hotline. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. We've also been getting, well, many, many emails. And if you'd like to email us, you can send us an email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. We'll be reading some of those comments in the coming days. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and when we come back, we'll find out what Jennifer saw. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!. I'm Amy Goodman. Eyewitness testimony is often considered solid evidence in a court of law, particularly in certain crimes such as rape. But a troubling new Frontline documentary, airing on PBS Tonight, raises new doubts about eyewitness testimony. The documentary, What Jennifer Saw, highlights the case of Jennifer Thompson, a rape victim, who misidentified her attacker and helped send him to jail for 11 years.
It was a wonderful feeling. It showed that what we had felt all along was correct.
First time in a long time you're walking out of here today as a free man.
It was very emotional in the Alamance County courtroom yesterday when the judge virtually opened Cotton's locked cell. He says he doesn't carry bitterness about his imprisonment.
I was told that he would be on the news, and so I made sure I turned it on and watched it. I remember feeling just an overwhelming sense of just guilt that if indeed we had made a mistake and I had contributed to taking away 11 years of this man's life, and if indeed we had been wrong I felt so bad. I fell apart.
And that was Jennifer Thompson in the video documentary that will air tonight. Jennifer Thompson joins us in our studio right now, along with Ben Loderman, who's the producer of What Jennifer Saw. Jennifer, it's a powerful documentary that's going to air tonight, and this is your story. And the power of it is in what you saw and what you learned and what you realized after 11 years. Can you tell us briefly what happened?
I had gone to bed early the night of my rape and woke up at about 3 a.m. to a sound of feet shuffling beside my bed and thought perhaps I was dreaming, that I was having a nightmare, so I kind of closed my eyes and I heard it again, and I turned my head to the side and saw the top of a person's head, and I lived alone, and I asked who that was, who was there, and a man jumped on me and straddled my body and put a knife to my throat and told me to shut up or he was going to kill me. And at the beginning, I thought I was going to be robbed. Somehow he'd broken in and I had startled him. And he then proceeded to rape me, and I realized what was going to happen.
And you were able to take some control of the situation as you realized one thing you wanted to do was be able to identify him.
Correct. I realized I could smell alcohol in his breath, and I realized that he was armed, he was much larger than myself, and was under the influence of at least alcohol. And so the one advantage I thought and believed that I had over him was I could outsmart him. I could somehow get him to put the weapon away and perhaps either talk him into letting me go or escape myself.
Which you did.
Which I did.
Saying you wanted to get a drink of water, and then you went into the kitchen and ran out, whereupon he went and found someone else to rape down the street.
After he chased me.
After
he chased me.
So what happened? The police came, and talk about how you identified the person you thought was your attacker.
I was taken to the police station and asked if I could do a composite drawing. And so I sat down with a police artist, and we tried to sketch my memories with what noses and ears and eyes they had available for me to choose from. And we came up with a likeness of my assailant to as close as we could get. Then we went and did a photo lineup, which is where, you know, you have 6-8 photos of suspects. And I reviewed those and was able to pick a photo out that, of course, I believed was my rapist, which we now know was not.
What made you think it was him?
He looked like the man who raped me. I mean, and that's, it's what I've tried to explain to people is the photos that you are looking at are mugshots, so to speak, of convicted felons, but those pictures are usually 2, 5, 10 years old, and so the photos don't actually look like that person does now. And so the photo of Ronald Cotton looked like Bobby Poole, the man who had just raped me.
We're a little ahead of ourselves because you didn't realize it was someone else for many years. In fact, there were 2 trials for Ronald Cotton. He was convicted of rape in both.
Mm-hmm.
Were those 2 trials in your case or you and the other victim?
The first case we tried was just my case. The second victim was not able to make an identification and actually made not a very reliable witness. So we were almost afraid to try the 2 cases together in fear of her hindering my case. The second time it was both of our cases together.
And he was convicted both times.
And he was convicted both times.
So he went to jail for 11 years, continuing to talk about his innocence. And then you got a call from the prosecutor and also the police?
I actually got a call in spring of 95 from the detective who had worked on the case. And usually, I just from past experiences, when he called me, it was usually something to do with my case.
and told you that they're rethinking it?
He explained to me about DNA, that in light of the O.J. Simpson case, we now have a new tool available to us, and explained to me the series of who was involved with what and would I give a new blood sample, because mine had somehow been destroyed during the 11 years.
And you did?
I did.
And they did a DNA sample of the amazing that he had saved, the detective had saved the evidence from the crime.
Right.
And they learned that Ronald Cotton was not your rapist.
Right. There had been a mystery DNA that did not fit Ronald Cotton's DNA or anyone else that had been involved during that time. So we were looking for another suspect, obviously, another DNA, that mystery DNA, who it belonged to.
Well, let me bring Ben Loderman into this conversation, the producer of What Jennifer Saw. That sounds very strange, but the producer of this PBS documentary that'll air tonight on Frontline. How did you get interested in this case?
Well, we began looking at a number of cases that I learned the Justice Department was profiling as the result of Janet Reno's specific interest in DNA. And one of the things I decided in looking at what was then a group of 28 cases that now has blossomed to closer than to 40 cases was to ask myself and try to find out, what did the women who were raped in all of these cases, because 40 seemed like an extremely high number, what did they think when they were sitting at home watching the person who had been convicted come out of jail, be met at the prison gates by reporters and cameras, sometimes gain local and often national attention? In this case, Ronald Cotton, the man, was a guest on Larry King Live the week after he got out of jail. And I just thought to myself, my God, what does that woman sitting at home think and make of all this and DNA evidence?
You know, one interesting thing that I found in your documentary was an expert you talked to who said that cross-racial identification is particularly difficult, both with whites identifying blacks and blacks identifying whites. Why is that? And Jennifer, why do you think that is?
Well, I think that most races have a difficult time picking out distinguishable features of another race.
Perhaps in our society, because race is such an important issue, that is the most important thing we see.
Well, I think it's not to be confused with an issue of racism, but I think what social scientists have found is that we just have problems processing details of each other's features across racial lines. Blacks have trouble picking out whites, more trouble than they do picking out other blacks, and the same is true vice versa.
But unfortunately, the way our prison system works and the criminal justice system in this country, it's more likely that an African American will go to jail than a white person would go to jail.
There's no denying the truth of that.
At the end of the documentary, Ronald Cotton says that he hasn't gotten a chance to talk to you. And he wonders what you think. Ronald Cotton, who now works at the DNA lab that freed him. Have you talked to Ronald Cotton yet?
No, I haven't talked to Ronald Cotton yet. And this is, I think, a common question that, and I'll probably get it a lot more after tonight. I will talk to Ronald Cotton when I emotionally can do it. I'm not at the point yet where I can. I'm at the point where I want to, but I'm still afraid of my emotions and how best to deal with it and how best to handle it. And like I've explained a couple of times, when I do talk to Ronald Cotton, it will be a very private talk. It will not be for TV shows or anything like that. It'll be something between just Ronald Cotton and myself. And I do owe him an explanation. He deserves it, and he is owed it, and I will do it because I have to get just closer to closure for myself.
Jennifer doesn't know this, but when we began looking at the 28 cases we did, I began trying to talk to the women involved in almost all those cases and didn't come close to finding anyone who would talk about this on camera or on the record. I was able to talk to a couple women over the phone, ensuring their confidentiality. But it took, I think, a huge step for someone as brave as Jennifer to talk about it publicly for the first time. And I can imagine just how complex the issues are for her.
I was mugged a couple of times, and one of the times the police were pushing me hard to identify the guys. And I said, well, it's so obvious that this should be them, because they caught them running down the street beyond me. I just said, if I didn't know that they had run down the street, I couldn't say that I saw these three men. And the police were just throwing up their hands and saying, you women, you are much less likely to identify a person than a man. You're just much less likely. And yet in your case, you did, Jennifer. Did you have second thoughts through the trial? I mean, did you think at any point, what if this is not him, especially as he kept saying, I didn't do this?
In 1987, in the second trial, he was asked, was there anything he wanted to say? And Ronald Cotton stood up and he sang a song that he had written in prison. And at that point, I did think, God, suppose this isn't the guy. But it never at any time did I think he wasn't the guy. Does that make sense? Because your subconscious builds over years, and images become just etched in your brain. And when you have other pieces of evidence that come in, and then there's just layers of evidence and images, I think you almost get to the point where I thought to myself, well, there's just no way he's not.
In fact, you say in the documentary that you still see Ronald Cotton in your mind.
I do see him in my mind, but I want everybody to understand it's not that I want to see him in my mind. It's something that for 11 years, up until DNA came back and said Ronald Cotton didn't do it, Ronald Cotton was my rapist, and his face was in my mind. And no matter how hard, and I've tried, I mean, I have literally consciously tried to erase it. I can't. I mean, I know he didn't do it, though. I mean, I want him to know and everyone to know that I know he didn't do it.
The person who was gotten, his name is Bobby Poole, gotten only through DNA testing, and he immediately, once they got him, admitted it when they did this test of DNA on him. You've seen his picture. Does his picture ring a bell to you?
Yes. Yes and no. This was a long time ago. And images become blurred over years, and I think they cease being almost reality at some point and become nightmares. And
I think walking through the process that Jennifer did, by the time there was a second trial, years after the arrest, and Bobby Poole was actually brought into the courtroom, and she and the second victim looked at him, by that point they were both so convinced of Ronald Cotton's guilt that they could look at the man who raped him and say to people around them, that's not him. That's not him. That's just a diversion going on. And Bobby Poole's testimony was not admitted, and at that point he went free.
Well, in another show we do, we'll focus specifically on the Innocence Project that is here in New York at Cardozo Law School, that's run by Peter Neufeld and Barry Scheck, the two lawyers people may know from the O.J. Simpson trial. Ironically, they're showing how DNA isn't reliable, but in fact what they do is, using DNA, they often free men from jail. And we're going to talk about that. It is featured in this documentary that'll air tonight around the country on Frontline on PBS stations nationwide. I want to thank you very much, Jennifer, for joining us. Jennifer Thompson, who is the subject of this documentary and has dared to bear her life to the American public. And Ben Loderman, thanks for taking on this issue, the producer of What Jennifer Saw.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Julie Drizin is the executive producer of Democracy Now! Thanks to Kevin Cartwright, engineered out in California. Also thanks to Zachary Fink and Bernard White. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!